Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight we hear first from East Asian expert Joseph Fewsmith on the political succession in China.
The political report that Jiang Zemin gave to the Party Congress set out a vision of economic modernization and social development that I think just looks very familiar in the East Asia context.
And then from poet and translator Michael Hoffman on literary translations of Wolfgang Köppen's Death in Rome.
When I set out, I didn't know how I would find Savile. I certainly didn't go into it for the purpose of bashing him.
That's all coming up tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The chief UN weapons inspectors say they've noticed the beginning of what they say could be a change of heart by Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Baghdad.
Chief UN Inspector Hans Blix said breakthrough is a strong word for the talks, but he added, I would much rather see inspections than some other solution, referring to Washington's threats to launch war. Asked about a statement by President Bush that the game was over for Iraq, Blix replied, we are still in the game. The Iraqis handed over documents, which will take some days to assess. The inspectors are encouraged. Some Iraqi scientists have now agreed to private interviews, but Blix acknowledged Iraqi compliance remains a mixed bag, with some scientists continuing to balk. The inspectors did not get Iraqi agreement on using American U-2 surveillance planes, but Iraqi officials have promised to answer by Friday when the chief inspectors give their next report to the UN Security Council. The inspectors told the Iraqis it's important to have 100% cooperation at this critical moment. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
The Bush administration is giving the cold shoulder to a German-French plan that would boost the number of weapons inspectors in Iraq. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice.
The problem isn't that we have 108 and we need 200 or 300. The problem is that Saddam Hussein is not complying. He is not disarming. He has not taken the decision to voluntarily disarm. That's the problem. And it will be a diversion if we start to move away from 1441.
That's the UN resolution demanding disarmament by Iraq. Rice was interviewed on CBS. More than a week after the space shuttle Columbia came apart during its return to Earth, investigators are still at a loss to explain the tragedy. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
Early on, NASA officials raised the possibility that there might be a very simple explanation. The shuttle's left wing had been damaged by a piece of debris, probably foam insulation, that came off the fuel tank during launch. But over the next few days, that hypothesis seemed to lose credence. NASA officials said tests and computer models suggested it was highly unlikely even a large piece of foam could cause enough damage to imperil the spacecraft. So by week's end, other ideas were in the spotlight. They included the possibility that the shuttle was struck by something as it orbited the Earth or as it began its return. Investigators hope they'll be able to test those ideas by examining pieces of the shuttle, hundreds of which have been found scattered across Texas and Louisiana. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
Gasoline prices have risen further over the past 2 weeks, up nearly 11 cents a gallon. The average price for a gallon of regular nationwide is now about $1.60. Crude oil prices have been climbing in anticipation of a possible war with Iraq and as a result of the oil production strike in Venezuela. But industry analyst Trilby Lundberg says she expects prices to level off in the coming weeks. This is NPR News.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Massachusetts cities and towns responding to heightened terror alerts are calling on the Bush administration and Congress to deliver promised federal funding for local security. City leaders say they're being asked to put police and firefighters on the front line, but that the president and the Congress have failed to supply, equip, and fund these departments. Boston has spent $2.6 million in extra security since the September 11th terrorist attacks. A published report is taking the lead contractor in the Big Dig to task for cost overruns. Today's Boston Globe says that Bechtel Parsons is responsible for at least $1.1 billion of the $1.6 billion in cost overruns on the project. Bechtel officials deny that overruns resulted from mismanagement or design flaws. And three firefighters were injured in a four-alarm blaze at a convenience store in South Boston last night. The fire also damaged houses on either side outside of the store. It took 100 firefighters about 2 hours to put out the blaze, which caused about $1.1 million in damage and also displaced 15 people. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ThoughtForm's Green Building Division, emphasizing environmentally sensitive and sustainable construction, located in Acton and on the web at thoughtforms-corp.com. By Johnson's Drugs in Waltham, a health and wellness pharmacy providing care with personal attention, offering an integration of mainstream and complementary medicine. And by the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, encouraging entrepreneurship across America, emkf.org. In the forecast tonight, mostly clear until about midnight and then becoming mostly cloudy through the overnight with lows in the low 20s. A winter storm watch will be in effect for tomorrow afternoon into the evening, with snow expected by early afternoon, highs in the mid-30s. Right now it's 30 in Boston, 29 in Chatham.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight in the first part of our program, we'll hear leading China expert Joseph Fewsmith as he addresses a monthly executive briefing in international affairs presented jointly by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and Boston University. Fewsmith is professor of international relations and political science and director of the East Asia Interdisciplinary Studies Program at BU. His most recent book is China After Tiananmen, The Politics of Transition. In the second part of our program, we'll hear from poet and translator Michael Hoffman on varying translations of Wolfgang Köppen's German masterpiece, Death in Rome, as part of the university professor's program of literary translation. Hoffman is an author in his own right, having won several major prizes for his poetry, as well as honors for his translations. Now here is Professor Joseph Fewsmith speaking on political succession in China. Does it matter?
I'm going to start a little bit from activities of last fall, that is to say the 16th Party Congress, which was held last November and was, of course, advertised as a transition of authority from the older generation, Jiang Zemin stepping down as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, to the younger generation, Hu Jintao, who was named as General Secretary. This was a Congress that in some ways, I think, sent both positive and not such positive signs. Let me start on the happy side of the story. The political report, the main report that Jiang Zemin gave to the Party Congress, set out a vision of economic modernization and social development that I think just looks very familiar in the East Asia context. The vision was of an urbanized, modernized, educated, developing middle-class society, sort of a Singapore writ large, indeed very, very large. Jiang Zemin vowed to quadruple the size of the Chinese economy over the next 20 years. Now, alas, I happen to be old enough to remember when Hu Yaobang said the same thing in 1982. He said that the Chinese economy would quadruple between 1980 and 2000. And I was pretty skeptical. I was certainly not alone. It seemed to me that a country the size of China, encumbered by the political institutions that it had, the weaknesses of its economy, would not be able to sustain the 7% growth required per year for two decades to be able to achieve that goal. Well, they didn't grow 7% a year. They grew faster. And in fact, they managed to achieve that goal of quadrupling the economy by about 1996, about 4 years ahead of schedule. And so this time, I can't dismiss the idea that the Chinese economy will grow at that rate for another two decades. There are, of course, a lot of political and economic difficulties in the banking sector and other areas that suggest a lot of problems. Nevertheless, it may happen. If it does, Chinese society in two decades is going to be simply vastly different than it was than it is now. One of the main themes of Jiang Zemin's report was to build what he called a comfortably well-off society. Call it a middle-class society. That is to say that the size of China's middle class would not only grow, of course, in absolute numbers, but as a proportion of the population. Right now, the middle class is very small. There is a middle class. It's very urban. If you're talking about really promoting the size of the middle class to, oh, the estimates of this vary tremendously, but if you say roughly 10% of the population now, if you're going to say even double that or more over the next couple of decades, you're talking about building a middle class society. China has never had a middle class society. And the social, economic, and political implications of that, I think, are profound. I also think they would be profoundly positive. It was, of course, in the context of calling for the development of this middle class society that Jiang Zemin called for admitting entrepreneurs, otherwise known as capitalists, into the Chinese Communist Party. This is quite interesting, not only for the obvious reasons that it seems a bit incompatible for a Communist Party to admit capitalists into its ranks, but also because just 13 years ago, when Jiang Zemin took over as General Secretary in the wake of the Tiananmen tragedy, he specifically said that there was a small group within the party that was trying to bring about a middle-class society and thereby overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. It would seem that Jiang Zemin is now a part of this small group of people, at least that are bringing about the transformation, if not the overthrow, of the Chinese Communist Party. Along with building a middle-class society, Jiang Zemin called for building institutions. To me, this is the much more difficult, the much more important, and the much more problematic task. Specifically, Jiang Zemin called for building an institutionalized, standardized, and procedure-based system. If they can do that, that would be, as, indeed, profoundly transforming, welcomed change indeed. I think there have been a lot of interesting things going on in terms of institution building at all levels of the Chinese society over the last decade or so. The legal system is far from being a healthy, sound legal system, but there have been a lot of laws passed. In the context of joining WTO, some 900 laws were reviewed, amended, in order to make them WTO compatible. China is now churning out many lawyers every year. There are now at least 150,000 practicing lawyers, not enough for Chinese society, but far more than they had a few years ago. The accounting enterprise is growing very rapidly. Hopefully they'll keep better books than some companies. In any case, the tax system has moved towards rationality. Better educated people are being promoted to responsible bureaucratic positions. Local elections in villages have been institutionalized and not evenly implemented, but they're beginning, I think, to creep up the system to the township level and maybe someday at a higher level. Non-state institutions, an important part of governance, is growing rapidly. There are now thousands of non-governmental organizations, or perhaps we'd rather regard these as so-called GONGOs, government-organized non-governmental organizations. Even if they are government-organized, they tend to have a considerable degree of autonomy, and they make a contribution to the governance of China and in what we political science might call interest articulation. For instance, just one quick example, there's a fascinating legal aid center set up in Wuhan University in central China. They specialize in suing the government, helping citizens that have specific problems where their rights have been trampled on by some government agency. They undertake these cases pro bono, and they take the government to court, and they're in the habit of winning. These are profound changes. Media is still controlled by the government, but is being given looser rein. It is playing a much greater role in exposing corruption and other such things. local people's congresses. China's always had people's congresses, but these have been known as rubber stamp agencies. They're beginning to take on a more interesting role. Just the other day, I heard that the Guangdong People's Congress, always moving one step ahead in southeast China there, for the first time was actually shown the government budget ahead of time, the numbers, in other words. This may seem normal to us, the way government should operate, but it is certainly not the way your father's Communist Party operated. One of the interesting experiments of the last few years is in the growth of the so-called inter-party democracy. This is one of those expressions that I think appropriately is greeted by a degree of skepticism. You undertake inter-party democracy because you don't want to do the real thing. Nevertheless, anything that would open up party procedures to make them a bit more competitive, opening up even voting within the party, is going to change the dynamic of the party. Different sorts of people are going to be promoted. People who are less cadre-like and more, if you will, politicians, in the good sense of the word, that have political skills, that are able to build coalitions. I think that that is a positive trend that may gain momentum over the next few years. So I think there are a lot of positive things that are going on in China, but building institutions is tough. And that's where some of the news out of the Party Congress is, I think, not so good. I know a lot of you won't be able to read this, and you don't have to read this. It probably won't mean too much, a lot of names, the old Politburo, the new Politburo. The point of this is, first of all, that the standing committee of the Politburo, where the real power lies, was expanded from 7 members to 9 members. And more importantly, the people that were promoted were all Jiang Zemin's friends. Jia Qinglin, Zeng Qinhong, Huang Zhu, Li Changchun. These people are what you would normally call cronies. And that is not a good sign in terms of institution building, especially if you're talking in terms of an institutionalized transfer of power from one leader, Jiang Zemin, to a younger leader, Hu Jintao. These are people whose political loyalties appear to be to Jiang Zemin. In other words, the succession really has not happened, despite the fact that Hu Jintao holds the title. Worse, a lot of these people have reputations. One can't speak of evidence, but certainly if the rumor mill is any indication, this is not the most honest group of people. They've feathered their nests rather well, if any of the rumors are to be believed. That doesn't set a very good example for people down the ranks. You look at the lineup here and you say, well, as long as you salute the guy at the top of the system, then forming personal factions and engaging in corruption is just fine. And to me, that is one of the really negative signals that may come out of this party Congress. It's something that I think needs to be watched very closely over time. Let me look a little bit at some of the social attitudes that are coming up in China and that are quite interesting. One of the things that China does now is every year it publishes what's called a blue book of Chinese society that analyzes the social trends. One of the most interesting surveys in the book is a survey of party cadres who are attending the Central Party School. The Central Party School now is itself become fairly dynamic, a reasonably freewheeling intellectual atmosphere. It's really what you would call a mid-career course. It's for people at lower levels of the system who have been generally earmarked as on the fast track for promotion. They go to the Central Party School in Beijing. It's out in the northwest, a very nice campus, and they spend from 3 months to a year, depending on their course, hobnobbing with policymakers that come in and give them talks about what's really, in fact, going on in China and so forth. Every year they give these provincial cadres that come in there an opinion survey. When they ask the most important problems facing China over the past year, what do these cadres point to? Income disparity, unemployment, corruption, social order, peasant burdens. Real problems in all these areas, and they're clearly recognized by the elite. That doesn't mean that they will necessarily deal with them, but they are very aware that you have these sorts of social problems out there. How do you maintain social stability? Keep the economy going. Incredible. Given a long list of 12 variables, they always say, keep the economy going. 70% land on that one. Secondarily, they point to such things as the need to construct a sound social security system, to reduce peasant burdens, and to resolve the problem of laid-off and unemployed workers. Interestingly enough, when asked about what are some of the things that will help or constrain economic and social development in the next decade, I'm overwhelmed by this. 80%, 79.8%, say we need to do political reform. Now, I'm under no illusion that what they mean by political reform is not democratization as we understand it, but there's a clear recognition, as expressed by the political elite, that their political system has got major problems. Problems of coordinating between the party and the state, problems of promotion system, problems of corruption. These are things that are clearly recognized that need to be dealt with. Related to that, build a healthy legal system. These are problems that are out there that need to be dealt with. One survey, this is a different survey. This is of the population rather than of cadres. This suggests, in a sense, that China has a little bit of time, at least if the economy keeps growing. Asked whether you expect your standard of living to increase over the or decrease over the next 5 years, the population is really fairly optimistic. You have 63% that say that their incomes are going to increase at least somewhat over the next 5 years. Only 7.5% say, yeah, my income is going to go down over the next 5 years. Now, there is a rather large 12% there that says, gee, I don't know, which suggests that there's a good bit of uncertainty out there as well. But basically, it suggests to me that they have some time if the economy keeps going, which also suggests that one of the real problems they could face is if the economy does not keep going. If there is some sort of an economic decline in China, God forbid something like an Asian financial crisis that really happens in China, those sorts of figures could be reversed very quickly and you'd have some real social problems. One survey I did not put up in this form was a survey of workers in the northeastern province of Liaoning, northeast of Beijing. This is an old industrial base where a lot of people have been laid off over the last few years. And there have been a lot of collective actions, demonstrations, strikes, and so forth in that area. And when asked whether they would join such a collective action, almost a third of the respondents said, yeah, sure, I'd join. Another 35% said, well, I'd be very sympathetic, but I wouldn't join. Well, you're never quite sure whether they would or they wouldn't. These have got to be somewhat disturbing numbers for the party. It says that there are a lot of people out there that under certain circumstances will take to the streets and demonstrate, demand better treatment, more jobs, Social Security, unemployment benefits, whatever the demand is. So you have some real potential social problems out there. Let me also turn to the Taiwan issue, because that's one of the major issues that is facing China over the next few years as well. And I was just in Taiwan as well as in Beijing talking about this issue. And it's always, of course, a critical issue in Sino-U.S. relations, very sensitive, on all sides of the straits. By the way, the same survey of party cadres, in a part of the survey that is not published, I'm told says that when asked about Chinese policy toward the United States, some 50% said it was too soft. When asked about policy toward Taiwan, 20 to 30% said, well, we need to take more vigorous measures to stop so-called Taiwan independence. I find these troubling figures. It suggests, among other things, that there's a fairly large gap between what the policymakers are in fact doing, the foreign policy elite, and what this broader political elite thinks that they should be doing. Right now, of course, the foreign policy elite has been adopting very moderate policy vis-a-vis the United States and Taiwan, and these relationships have been getting better, particularly over the past year or so. Whether or not these numbers get better, that is to say, move toward what the elite is actually doing, or whether the elite begins to move towards those figures strikes me as a rather critical issue over the next few years. I think that right at the moment, there are some positive, albeit mixed, as always, signs in cross-strait relations. Broadly speaking, President Chen Shui-bian of Taiwan has been moving toward the center of the political spectrum over the last couple of months, particularly very recently. Last August, he made a very controversial statement calling for one country on each side of the strait, Yi Bian Yi Guo. This is sort of one of those Taiwan independence slogans. It fires up the base. Clearly, he was positioning himself for the upcoming election. There's a presidential election coming up in Taiwan in March of 2004, about a little over a year from now. And you make such comments to go to the party faithful and, as they say, mobilize the base, a phenomenon that's not unknown in U.S. politics. But such statements, obviously, they create tensions across the straits. They also tend to alienate some of the middle-of-the-road voters, not to mention those who are on the so-called pro-unification side of things. You don't win elections by appealing to the base. You have to move to the center. And also, they don't make Washington very happy. Washington has its eye on other things right now and would like to keep the Taiwan Straits area peaceful. After some awkwardness in the early part of the administration, it's moved very clearly, I think, to, on the one hand, enhance ties with Taiwan, to treat Taiwan with greater dignity, to make sure that its defense needs are met, but also to say we don't want any actions that are provocative from either side. And so there has been support for, but also real constraint on Chen Shui-bian. And indeed, after his comment in August, Washington expressed its, I think, strong displeasure with those comments. Whether it's in reaction to the U.S., whether it's in reaction to Taiwan political opinion, whether it's in anticipating the upcoming election, Chen Shui-bian clearly moved back to the center. And in his January 1st speech, he called for constructing a stable and cooperative framework of relations across the strait. Of course, just the other day, you saw one manifestation of a slightly improved relationship across the strait when the first Taiwan airliner in half a century landed in Shanghai. It did not fly directly across the strait. It flew to Hong Kong, touched down for about 40 minutes, and then flew on to Shanghai. Nevertheless, this was some small break in the so-called three links, this notion that you should be able to conduct telecommunications, shipping, and, of course, air travel across the straits directly. This has become, I think, a critical issue, critical in Taiwan's own economic development. The business community is demanding the three links, especially air traffic. There are now approximately 300,000 Taiwanese living in and around Shanghai. And to be able to fly back to Taipei in 2 hours rather than going to Hong Kong, probably spending the night there because of scheduling problems and then taking the flight out the next morning, obviously that would benefit Taiwan a great deal. Facing both these sorts of pressures and electoral pressures of next year, I'm told that Taiwan's National Security Council is about to release an assessment of the economic impact of the three links on the Taiwan economy. This is, I think, intended both to signal a moving forward, but also an attempt to control this process. That is to say, they'd like to phase in some aspects of the cross-straits flights as they try to protect themselves in various ways economically. I was also told that they are considering, and this would be a dramatic change, opening up Taiwan to mainland tourism to the tune of something like 300,000 a year. This would be a dramatic opening to the mainland. Now, of course, you always have the question of, do they mean it? Chen Shui-bian does have his base that he likes to mobilize, and it's a pro-independence base. On the other hand, the business community and the long-term economic pressures on Taiwan says you have to have better economic relations with the mainland. He's obviously put this forward, I think, both for economic reasons but also for political reasons. This is called positioning yourself in the run-up to the election. We don't know yet the opposition ticket. The Taiwan politics are divided between the so-called blues and the so-called greens. The blues are the old Nationalist Party and the People's First Party that split off from the Nationalist Party some years ago. These were the old ruling parties, or it used to be one ruling party. They split, divided, split the vote, and that's what allowed Chen Shui-bian to win the election 4 years ago. His own party split off, part of it split off, with the former president Lee Teng-hui forming a Taiwan Solidarity Union, which now has become the real voice of sort of pro-independence sentiment. And so you have divisions on both sides. And the interesting dynamic, of course, is whether or not the so-called blue parties can field a single candidate. Chen Shui-bian won the 2000 election as a plurality winner. He had about 40% of the popular vote. If the blues can get it together and field one candidate, they have a real chance of winning the election. The problem, of course, is the problem that they face, and the reason that they split 4 years ago is, will the candidate be you or me? The usual problem that you face, whether Lien Zhan, the head of the Kuomintang, who appears to be utterly unelectable, will step down? Probably not. He feels like he's in charge of the old party, the established party, and that that Song Chu-yu, the head of the People's First Party, should be the one who yields to him. We'll have to see how that dynamic plays out. The interesting thing about the proposal that I just mentioned about cross-strait relations is this positions Chen Shui-bian to say, look, I'm putting forward a very moderate, reasonable proposal. If the mainland responds positively, it proves that I can handle cross-strait relations in a responsible, mature manner. They'll deal with me. If the mainland refuses to respond positively, Chen Shui-bian can also say, look, I've tried. I've put forward a reasonable proposal. And if you blues think that that proposal was not, you know, that you should put forth an even softer one, then you really don't favor Taiwan interests. You know, heads I win, tails I you lose sort of situation. It puts Beijing in a dilemma. We heard in a trip that I was just in Shanghai, Beijing, we heard mixed voices, some responding positively, some negatively. My sense of things is that they will respond positively because the mainland, I think both Beijing and Taipei in a sense really do agree that if those air links are ever negotiated and established, that this will create a sense of psychological momentum that will tie Taiwan politically into China. Negotiating those links is the tricky problem. How do you negotiate those links? The mainland has what's called the Association for Relations Across the Taiwan Straits. Taiwan has its counterpart organization, the Straits Exchange Foundation. Both of these are sort of arm distance government organizations, but they're really official organizations. Taiwan would love to negotiate these government to government. That would prove that Taiwan is a separate, independent, sovereign state recognized by the mainland. That's why the mainland will never do that. The mainland would prefer to handle these business to business. We'll send our airline executive to talk to your airline executive, and we can hammer out a deal. Taiwan won't accept that end of the spectrum. The interesting thing that has, I think, come up just quite recently is the idea that you might accept, Taiwan might accept, something that's called the Hong Kong model. The Hong Kong model here is the model that was used to negotiate air links between Hong Kong and Taiwan after Hong Kong was went back under Chinese sovereignty. Again, you could not do this government to government without recognizing China, Taiwan independence, which the Hong Kong government, rather influenced by Beijing, was not willing to do. So what you do is you send basically a private delegation to meet a private delegation, but in those delegations you have government officials that are not identified as government officials. I mean, everybody knows who they are. There's no secret. This is merely for face. And they go along as experts, advisors, members of the delegation, something of that nature. And so you work out this sort of mixed model. In the past, Taiwan has been quite adamant in refusing this, holding out for government-to-government talks. As of a couple of weeks ago, they indicated to the group that I was with that they were now considering accepting this model. Now, this does provide for some flexibility. This is tough because both sides are extremely suspicious of each other. I wouldn't predict any immediate or rapid breakthrough. Certainly by the summer, the election campaign is going to be heating up, but this does suggest that it is going to be a very interesting year of China watching.
Professor of International Relations Joseph Fewsmith, speaking on political succession in China. Does it matter? We now hear from poet and translator Michael Hoffman, whose work has been honored with the Chumley and Faber Prizes for poetry. In addition, he has twice won the Translator Association's Schlegel Tick Prize, first for Patrick Susskind's Double Bass, and the second time for the translation he will discuss today, Death in Rome. He appears as part of the University Professors Program on Literary Translation. Now, Michael Hoffman, with excerpts from Death Warmed Up, translation of the Wolfgang Köppen masterpiece, Death in Rome.
Even in the maximalist setting of these talks, and before this illustrious assembly of the faithful, it will probably be felt that translation, prose translation, my métier or day job, is a little obscure, if not downright devious. It's nasty work, but someone has to do it, maybe. Certainly, it will never be respected or understood per ardua, but you can forget ad astra. A service industry. Remember, I think, Fourier or Saint-Simon, some 19th century Frenchman, advocating the use of children, who naturally love dirt, in collecting garbage, or whatever fragrant euphemism they have for that in American. In the same way, the salvaging of works unwise enough to have got themselves written in some other language can be left to translators who love grubbing around in words. Society will provide. Best not to think about it too much. At most, it's the least hindrance. The translator is even less than the Victorian child, neither seen nor heard. The translation is pane of glass. Think of the standard lexicon of praise. Faithful, readable, clear. When was the last time a translation was described as hilarious, or savage, or overwhelming? What other writer goes to the lengths of supplying a historically authenticated name, a real pseudonym, a cast-iron alias, the so-called author, to put on the spines of books he writes? Only the translator. And what does he get in return? Milan Kundera goes through, as it were, five translation rinses to get the build-up washed out of his text and his semicolons respected. This in a book called The Joke. Martin Amis expresses real astonishment at the idea that anyone would read a translation for the style. Thank you both. I know. At this point, I like to quote a tiny poem of Pound's, two lines, called Epitaph. Lucis, who intended a grand passion, ends with a willingness to oblige. Having translated now some 30 books from the German, mainly 20th century novels, I know all about this willingness to oblige. So naturally, when I was invited to talk to you, I thought I'd tell you about my grand passion. Because as a translator, I would say, one wants above all to make a difference. The reader may not want you, and the author may not want you, or in each case they think they don't, but you can still occasionally fling yourself at something. Whatever your passion is, you want it to be someone's Bible. And this is a copy of the, this is actually an East German edition of Death in Rome, looking rather like a Bible. From the time I first read it, I wanted to translate Wolfgang Köppen's 1954 novel, Death in Rome. I had been put onto it by a bookseller in Berlin sometime in the late 80s. I knocked on doors, wrote reports, bent ears. Once, over dinner with the publisher, I even pulled a copy out of my bag and started to extemporize a translation for him between courses. Probably I should tell you something about Köppen. Not that I knew much about him myself at the time. He was alive still and eminent. He died in 1996. And yet his reputation had an aura of adolescent surliness about it. This meant to sound attractive. He had published a couple of novels in the 1930s. Then his career was deeply interrupted by the Third Reich and the Second World War. And then he emerged from his obscurity, or Versunkenheit, to write three more novels very quickly. Pigeons on the Grass in 1951, The Hothouse in 1953, and Death in Rome in 1954. These books, set one in Munich, one in Bonn, the then capital of the then Federal Republic, and one in the Eternal City, were known as Köppen's trilogy or post-war trilogy. They caused vast offence, did tremendously badly with the public and the critics, and yet a handful of people loved them. I didn't know this at the time. For instance, the late Siegfried Unseld, the director of Sorkamp for the past 40 years, broke his heart and almost his wallet in the unsuccessful effort of getting Köppen established. He kept him on a retainer for decades while Köppen apparently worked away at his big book, but there wasn't ever really the big book. Or there was Germany's most powerful literary critic, Marcel Reich-Ranitzky, who adored Köppen and again tried everything to get him to go. Again, I didn't know this either. Once Köppen was dead, Reich-Ranitzky collected his various eulogies and put them in a single volume, a little like Thomas Hardy. There were these irresistible forces, and there was Köppen, the immovable object, someone with an old reputation for trouble and difficulty, who wouldn't go away. So I translated Death in Rome. It began Es war einmal, and it ends with a corrupt version of the ending of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice. I don't remember too much about it, except that the sense of passionate identification I had with it persisted. Nothing seemed too much trouble, and I went over it endlessly, even more endlessly than usual. I love this prose like I love nothing else. It's a book I continually reread in English. They were what the poet Les Murray calls teacup and Remington days, or in my case, coffee and my father's Olympia. And then I had the pages blown up to A3 size for revising and editing. This was my own innovative contribution to what may be seen as a technical process. The publisher, not in the end the man I translated aloud to over dinner, gave me a young editor with, I think, similarly exalted feelings about the book. He, for instance, actually went to Rome on his honeymoon, and hence was able to save us from repeating a misprint that appears in the original. Viale del Muro Torto, not Muro Torot. It wasn't till I was writing my introduction and questing for facts that I made the startling discovery that Death in Rome had been translated into English once before. Into Russian, Polish, Czech, Bulgarian, Lithuanian, etc. It was one of those dissident West German novels that appealed mostly across the Iron Curtain, but also English. TR.TR, Mervyn Saville, London, Weidenfeld and Nicholson, 1956, and also New York, Vanguard Press, 1961. I felt cheated of my discovery, but after a time, jealousy gave way to curiosity. Then, last year, thanks to the service of alibris.com, I got hold of my predecessor's book. I copied, cut, and pasted three consecutive passages from very near the beginning, and had the appallingly coquettish notion that I might set them before you unidentified and have you make up my talk for me, hoping that, with luck and a minimum of guidance, you might end up preferring my version. But fantasy didn't last long. Translation, as I began by suggesting, is a fiddly, low-key kind of business, and perhaps seeing two versions of something will show you just how fiddly. The two selections you have before you are broadly similar. You should be able to tell without too much trouble that they are in fact the same story. The cat, the composer in Rome, the car, and the cat's kidnapping. According to Martin Amis, that's about as good as it gets. What might surprise you, then, is that there are only three sentences that are identical in the two versions. Three sentences in six pages. All three in the second passage, on pages 4 and 5. Which means that in two of the passages, there are no identical sentences at all. I can't quite get over this. Two of these sentences are just four words long. Whoever could ate well, and I have no idea. The third is a little longer. It goes, Rome is a wonderful city for men. Seven words. Remember, I wasn't trying to be different. I wasn't aware that I had a predecessor. I was just trying to do a good job. And later, when I chose these particular passages, I did it blindly because I liked them. My statistical sampling, in other words, isn't bent. I don't know anything about Mervyn Saville. I don't know if he translated or wrote any other books. I don't know under what circumstances he came to translate Death in Rome. It forms no part of my purpose to diss him. I don't want him as what the British call an Aunt Sally, something you put up to knock down, an Aunt Saville. Just as I'm not here to pat myself on the back either. What interests me is translation as a controlled accumulation of infinitesimal differences. That, I think, is where the virtue of a particular translation can be assessed. It's such things as self-consistency, authority, plausibility, conviction, belief, pleasure. A ditch runs round the Pantheon. It was once a street leading from the Temple of All the Gods to the Baths of Agrippa. When the Roman Empire collapsed, this ditch became covered with rubbish, but archaeologists unearthed it, bringing to light weather-beaten, moss-covered wall foundations which were to become a home for cats. There are cats all over Rome. Saville has ditch, which is agricultural and orderly, and possibly a bit on the small side. He has the faintly comical runs. How many times, you ask yourself? He has a semicolon, and then a rather awkward it, to pick up the subject. He has this ditch, by now holding on to a slightly remote-feeling subject. He has the rather illogical and shallow, covered with rubbish. The problematic, unearthed. Can you unearth a ditch? Isn't it like I met a man who wasn't there? He has the further, deeper contradiction that these dug-up, brought-to-light wall foundations are also, mysteriously, weather-beaten and moss-covered. I suppose it's like God hiding fossils in 4005 BC. Further, his word rubbish is used again at the end of the passage, this time to describe the food the cats are fighting over. He has two sentences that are awkward, contradictory, lacking in purpose, requiring the strenuous shift of tense, like a grinding of gears, which were to become, and in the end, to say not very much. It isn't until he gets to his third sentence, there are cats all over Rome, that the reader can breathe. You might say that a feature of Savile is a mild pointlessness. They bear the names of Caesars. They are called Otho, Caligula, Nero, Tiberius. Well, that seems to be true. The second part of the sentence bears out the first. Only, why mention it? What's interesting about it? Then, just afterwards, almost halfway down the page, the children have loud, shrill, excitable voices which foreigners find enchanting. Again, why? But it's a little worse than that, because there's nothing in that bland sentence that notes or passes comment on the slight unreasonableness of these foreigners. Then, there is a way in which things are not signalled. The translator's baton doesn't work properly. That is the beauty of Italy. There are shouts of laughter. Why now? Because beauty is funny. Sentences have a kind of matter-of-fact futility. Compassion always appears in some helpless guise. The old woman hobbles along on her stick, bringing food for the cats. A moist, repulsive newspaper conceals a mess of fish heads. Note the ruinous, levelling effect of the semicolons. Everything goes along indifferently at the same pace. Not the cinematic dérobade or striptease that Köppen purposed. What exactly does helpless mean? Isn't she rather being helpful? Why is the inadequate, even perversely succulent, moist there? How can the newspaper be said to conceal anything? It certainly doesn't in this sentence. Then there is the matter of fact, followed by the illogical. This is three-quarters of the way down. Both of them are short-sighted, and their spectacles gleam. Well, they would, wouldn't they? But see how blandly and efficiently the political edge has been smoothed out of the sentence. And then, compressed lips feign a hypocritical smile. Not a real smile. They feign a hypocritical smile. Then, the verbs that matter are weak. Throws, and this is the cat's growl. Throws and fall among, completely eclipsed by growl and spit and tail switching. Anyway, what have the cats got to be angry about if they are being fed? But draw the line at the strangely misguided interpolation of suffering humanity and the depth to which only cats can sink, and at endearingly in the last sentence, both of which involve slight but damaging misreadings. Object also, this is the only point relating to the German that I want to bring up here, to limbs of molten plastic, halfway down the first page. Plastic, as in English, can be statues. These are cast bronzes, not molten plastic. Perhaps one might make a case for the translator's processes being at least as interesting as the writer's, like poetry being at least as well written as prose. The slight inaccuracy, the spoken feel of the awful mob of cats were gnawing me, or felt reminded of the cats. The word maybe varied with perhaps, but especially maybe, which might be Siegfried's motto. I wasn't sure. I had a feeling. I could tell. I thought. I was interested. The imperfect. The cognitive, cognescent imperfect. The only thing that allows you, the English reader, to infer anything about the shape of Köppen's sentences is the shape of Köppen's paragraphs. That is, in those instances where Köppen's paragraphs are respected. Most of my sentences, upwards of 90%, I should think, follow Köppen's, and my paragraphing certainly does. I've always been impressed with translators who fiddle with the sentences of their originals, but maybe it's something they shouldn't do, Well, not without thinking about it more. When I set out, I didn't know how I would find Savile. I certainly didn't go into it for the purpose of bashing him. I was surprised that he made quite as many mistakes as he did, but mistakes are, or ought to be, beside the point. Translation overwhelmingly is a question of English, and I've deliberately kept my references to German to a minimum. As translations go, Savile's is probably not outstandingly bad, and certainly I'm not here to tell you how good I think mine is. I can't extrapolate from the individual cases. I wouldn't know whether in general standards have improved or declined. My guess is they remain about the same. As a translator and as a reader, I'm interested in what is possible. I don't see why prose shouldn't be as interesting as poetry, why something extensive shouldn't also be intensive, or translation as responsible or autonomous as an original. John the Baptist for people who will never see Jesus. I've tried to show you that translation makes a difference, and not just in terms of faithfulness, the Pilkington scale, and that there's no great mystery to that. It's not even all that subjective either. If you have a passion for a book, it helps, and it shows. I'm exasperated, as probably most translators are, by the bland mixture of fear and ignorance and pedantry that characterizes just about every response to a translation that I've ever come across, certainly prose. Judgments shouldn't be left to linguists. Most likely, they would only express a professional hankering for the original. The logic of their position almost forces them to be dogs in the manger, if not cows in the kennel. In any case, I don't do my work for Germanists. I do it for people without German. Most of what I've had to say could have been said without reference to German, and I could easily have done without it altogether. The use of my own text as an example is fortuitous and possibly a distraction. I could imagine myself speaking on other English translations, perhaps not even from the German. But maybe you wouldn't have believed me then. Thank you very much.
Michael Hoffman with excerpts from Death Warmed Up, translation of the Wolfgang Köppen masterpiece Death in Rome. Earlier we heard from Professor Joseph Fewsmith on political succession in China. Does it matter? For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 each and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Keith Infantino with help from Andy Farnsworth and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR. Coming up ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Dana-Farber Partners Cancer Care, a collaboration among Mass General Hospital, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Brigham and Women's Hospital, working together to fight adult cancer. cancercare.harvard.edu. And by A Street Frames, 21 years of frame making for galleries, artists, and the public, offering museum-quality framing and professional advice in Cambridge near Fresh Pond and in Boston's South End, astreetframes.com. In the forecast, mostly clear until about midnight, then becoming mostly cloudy through the overnight with lows in the low 20s. A winter storm watch will be in effect for tomorrow afternoon into the evening. Snow expected by early afternoon with highs in the mid-30s.